Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Today's topic is really fitting for this particular program because it tells us more about our own hometown. Who were the first people here? How did they live? If we erased all the infrastructure that has grown up on our landscape and met the people who have made this place their home for centuries, what would Anchorage look like? Where did people live? Where did they work? How did they eat? What did they do for fun? They were like us, but Cook Inlet was very different back then. We know at least some of this from a current exhibit at the Anchorage Museum, The Dena'ina Way of Living. And today we have two of the three exhibit curators to share stories and details of Cook Inlet's very first residents. So please welcome to our show, Aaron Leggett. Hi, Aaron.
Hello.
Aaron is a Dena'ina Athabascan, and he's a co-curator of this show, so it's very special that he's with us. And we have Jim Fall. Hi, Jim.
Good afternoon.
And Jim is a cultural anthropologist.
That's correct.
Working with the Subsistence Division of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Long title, Jim. And you have been here a very long time.
Not as long as many of the Dena'ina people, that's for sure. But
you're a newcomer.
Yeah, but I began working with the Dena'ina people in 1978 when I was a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin and was fortunate enough to meet Shem Pete and his son Billy Pete and a number of other Upper Inlet Dena'ina elders and work with them pretty intensively for a year as part of my graduate studies. And I returned to Alaska from the University of Wisconsin in 1981 and got the job with the Division of Subsistence, and as they say, the rest is history.
The rest is history. And Aaron, you're from around these parts. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Sure. Well, in 1981, I was born here in Anchorage at the old Alaska Native Services Hospital.
Over on, is it third? Wait, was it?
Yeah.
Third on the cliff, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And so I was educated here. I went to school all throughout, including college. I'm a graduate of the University of Alaska Anchorage, and I have a bachelor's degree in anthropology. And for the last about 10 years, I've worked a variety of jobs in kind of creating a public awareness for the Dena'ina people. So,
And I hope we have callers with questions about this because it's really a special opportunity because of this exhibit to learn a whole lot more about Anchorage, the place that we kind of take for granted. So I'm going to throw out our phone numbers in case people have calls or questions in their mind. If you're in Anchorage, you can call us at 550-8433. Outside of Anchorage, it's 1-888-353-5752. And we can also take your questions via email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So before we got started, I said to Jim and Aaron, maybe the first part of the show, let's set the stage for what, you know, wipe out Northern Lights and the BP building and the Fourth Avenue Theater and and tell us what I know it would have been full of trees, mm-hmm. but really, what would it have been like here? How many people were here? How were they organized? Where were their main headquarters? I mean, just fill it in for us.
Maybe I'll start
Jump
out.
In?
Sure. The area around Anchorage is part of what we like to refer to as Dena'ina Utlana, which means the Dena'ina homeland, and specifically the Dena'ina of the Knik Arm area were called Kanaktana. And the Anchorage area, as far as we know, did the Anchorage Bowl did not have a permanent winter village. The Dena'ina were a village people. They were not year-round nomads moving from place to place. This is something that was really emphasized to us by elders. And the villages in the Knik Arm area were at Idlalot, which would be a Klutna, or Ganagatnu, which is Knik, and some other places.
So
and
they were sort of permanent
That's
spots.
Right. And where people lived in the winter, they had their homes, which were log homes with birch bark roofs called nichich in Dena'ina. It's where they would store their supplies of fish and game and oil. But Anchorage would have been used seasonally. And one thing that you would have seen in Anchorage is fish camps along Ship Creek, along at Point Warrensoff.
Down by the port.
That's right. Uh-huh. Along Chester Creek, and we would have seen camps along there with smokehouses and fish racks. and fish traps. And
were people mostly walking, or how were they moving around?
Yeah, they mostly traveled by foot. They did have skin boats. The Dena'ina, being the only northern Athabascans to live on salt water, did borrow the technologies from primarily the Aleutic, but some technologies from the Yupik as well. So we did utilize skin kayaks and open skin boats, but
So moving up and down the coast.
Yeah, moving up and down the coast. But the Dena'ina really do talk about being a people that walked everywhere. They really did travel. They were well accomplished. And even people say of my great-grandmother's generation would walk from Anchorage to Klutna and back and forth, and it wouldn't think anything of it. You got to remember, too, they'd follow the coast, and there was no military bases, and so they would just come right down.
Were there must have been established footpaths that people knew about? Were there known trails that were really common?
There were, but people also moved along the water quite a bit. From place to place. But there were trails along the coast and following the streams inland. I would say if you visited Anchorage before it was Anchorage in the springtime, you'd encounter a fair number of Dena'ina people at the mouth of what's called Dlayaitnu, which is now called Ship Creek. And that means Needlefish Creek or Stickleback Creek in English. That's the Dena'ina name for it. And the reason Dena'ina would come there in the springtime from their winter villages is that the needlefish run very early, before the ducks and geese arrive, before the hooligan arrive, before the salmon
arrive. Do they have to ice fish for them?
No, or? By this time they would be dip netting them in the creek and basically drying them and boiling them up as basically a way to get from low supplies from the wintertime to the time when the salmon and other other more
so
abundant
resources.
It's a
real popular spot then. So, I mean, people are hungry at the end of a winter. And
so you would see the camps being established there in the springtime.
Yeah. I don't know this. Was it matriarchal? Was it a matriarchal society?
The term that we normally use is matrilineal.
Matrilineal, thank you.
So matriarchy refers to a political organization where women are basically running the show.
And, matrilineal?
Matrilineal means that the Dena'ina trace their descent through the female line only. So boys and girls belonged to the clan, to the descent group of their mother. And the clans regulated marriage. They regulated where people could live and who they worked with. Mm-hmm. The Dena'ina were a kinship-based society, as they still are today.
Mm-hmm. And I think, Aaron, when you and I were meeting and talking originally, I think there were about 6,000 people here at the height. Is that right?
Probably 6,000, somewhere in that neighborhood. The Dena'ina were the most numerous of all northern Athabascans. And again, a lot of that has to do with the fact that they lived on salt water, and they were more sedentary.
Uh-huh. So settled and stayed and established, I guess.
And we should add that 5,000 to 6,000 people refers to the Dena'ina population for the entire Dena'ina homeland. Because the Dena'ina, besides living in the upper Cook Inlet area and the Anchorage area, the Susitna River and Tyonek, occupied most of the Kenai Peninsula, the west side of Cook Inlet, the northeastern portion of Iliamna Lake and Lake Clark and the upper Stony River as well. 41,000 or more square miles is the Dena'ina homeland.
Wow. That's impressive. And if you think about using boats and walking to move around, I wanted to ask about trading. Like, who were their trading partners?
Sure. The Dena'ina were well-positioned to trade with a variety of people. As I mentioned, they would trade with the Aleutic of perhaps Kodiak Island. It's not clear whether they would go to Kodiak or the Aleutic would come up, or they'd meet somewhere in the middle, but they would trade with them. The primary people that they would trade with, though, was the Otna Athabascans, who were to the northeast of the Dena'ina. So, if you follow the highway out that way.
Right.
But then also, especially during the 19th century, after the introduction of Russian trade goods, there were Dena'ina that would go over the mountain passes into the upper Kuskokwim area and trade with the more interior Athabascans, and perhaps even in the northern section of Upper Cook Inlet, perhaps some of the lower, or not, with the Tanana Athabascans is what it would be as well.
And what were the commodities? What was, you know, what did the Dena'ina have to offer and what did they need?
Well, what they had to offer was sea resources, number one, I would say. So things like seal oil, beluga meat, they would make rope from the beluga hide, seal skins, but also some of the biggest salmon runs that we see occur in South Central Alaska, you know, the Kenai River or the Susitna River, Tyonek. So they would trade fish, and then those would be the main staples that would be traded to them. And then what the Dena'ina would trade for, especially with the Atna, would be for dentalium shells. In Athabascan society, and especially in Dena'ina as well, dentalium shell is a sign of status and wealth. And these shells actually were harvested down around Vancouver Island in British Columbia and then traded up the northwest coast.
How could we talk about the value of them? They're very valuable.
Extremely valuable. Yeah, they were.
And describe them, because they're quite lovely. They're long and cream-colored.
Yeah, they're a long, thin, tubular shell that you don't have to modify to string up. And all Athabascan groups use them. But also, they were traded up and down the west coast as far as California, and I think as far to the east as, like, the Great Lakes region. So it was a very valuable trade commodity.
Go ahead, Jim.
And I would add that the Dena'ina frequently traded with each other as well.
Right, yeah.
And an interesting example of that is the Dena'ina name for Point McKenzie, right across from Anchorage on the other side of Kinnick Arm. That's Delhi Tutsdalutspai Dalau, which means the point where we brought Hooligan. And what would happen there is that the Susitna River people, who had very strong runs of Hooligan, would put up the Hooligan oil and bring it to Point McKenzie, and they would trade with the Kinnick Arm people, mostly for mountain resources,
right,
such as especially sheep, and they also hunted goats. Sheep were really a major land resource for for the Kinnick Arm people, and the Susitna people really liked to get sheep.
Now, were there patterns, predictable patterns for this trading? Because there's no cell phones, there's no communication. So maybe were there times of the year that you just knew that you could do this, or were there signaling systems?
Absolutely. There were specific times of the year when people got together, and especially in the springtime. And place names, as I just mentioned, signal some of those important locations. The mouth of the Susitna River was a very important spot where people from Kinnick Arm, from the villages up the Susitna and Yetna River and Tyonek, got together to trade salmon, to trade beluga products that the Tyonek people were especially specialized in. And down from the upper reaches of the Susitna and the Yetna would come caribou meat and caribou hide. So that was a springtime activity.
Really, lots of goods and lots of commodities trading and actually adding pretty to a pretty nice lifestyle, it sounds like.
Well, that's right. And the leaders of the Dena'ina villages, who were called Kashka, which is best translated as rich man or rich men, would be the organizers of this trade. And they would have trading partners in the other villages. And a lot of that trade would also take place in the wintertime. The wintertime is a really easy time to travel around.
Yeah.
Right.
And so one would keep track and have potlatches at that time and exchange resources.
Mm-hmm.
In late winter, early spring, if things were getting tough and one village had a bit more than another, the trading would also take place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and again, this is, you know, organized around the clan system. And so you would have, you know, you would have partners in different communities that you would trade with. You'd also have relatives in other communities. So it was a great way to organize the society.
A big network. If you've just joined us, we're talking about the Dena'ina Athabascans of our region, of the Cook Inlet region, all the way down to Kenai and all the way up to, we named some of them.
Talkeetna, Chickaloon, Upper Yetna River.
And they were known as walking people. They we talked to this morning about how they might walk from Aklutna to the coast. And so I want to mention Aaron Leggett is here with us and Jim Fall. We have a caller, so I'm going to go ahead and take that question. Hi, Dawn.
Hi.
How are you, and what's your question?
I'm good, thank you. Well, my question is that I wanted to commend the curators for the wonderful exhibit and also raising awareness. I've heard about the exhibit through the paper and on the radio, and I think it's just wonderful. I'm at the Baskin, but from further up north. But my question is what kind of work will continue after the exhibit is over to, you know, continue the message about Dena'ina being the first people here? And an example I can think of is there's a statue of Captain Cook downtown, and I'm wondering if what kind of work will continue in terms of getting more displays and exhibits and information in the community.
It's a good one for you, Aaron, huh?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for calling, Don. You know, we've done a lot to increase public awareness over the last 6 or 7 years. There's interpretive signage throughout the Anchorage Bowl now. There's still more that needs to be put up. Myself and Jim Fall and others testified for the naming of the new Civic Convention Center, which became Dena'ina. So that's really helped to increase public awareness. But
Just to get
the word out there. Yeah. But it's a never-ending process, and so I don't think that our work will ever be done. We've discussed, you know, the fact that there's a statue in downtown Anchorage to a man who was here for less than 2 weeks, never got off the boat.
I love that line. He never got off the boat, and yet we have a statue too.
And didn't really like this area. He wanted to go back to Hawaii. Perhaps one day we'll have a Dena'ina statue somewhere prominent that can tell our story. But, anytime that there's an opportunity that presents itself, we try to make ourselves available to try to do that. You know, our hope is that perhaps some interpretive material can go to the Anchorage Airport and other places like that. So
I was imagining, I told Jim before the show, I wish we had an app on our iPhone. We could walk around Anchorage and just hear what was going on here.
There's actually work in right now. They're working on with the Centennial of Anchorage, and it's called Augmented Reality, and it'll do just that. It'll actually have these locations with an iPhone. Mm-hmm. So there is all sorts of work that is.
Oh, wow. I had not heard about it. And that's probably going to be all kinds of history, not just Dena'ina history?
Correct. Uh-huh. Yeah. So there's, with the Centennial of Anchorage, we've really been pushing, and we've gotten pretty good feedback to make sure that you really can't tell the history of Anchorage without first talking about the indigenous people of the Anchorage area.
Yeah. And Jim, go ahead.
And I would add, Aaron mentioned the interpretive signs that have really been developed quite a bit in Anchorage over the past 5 to 10 years. And back when we first got started on this, really the only mention that one could find about the Dena'ina in Anchorage was a sign on the corner of F Street and Third Avenue as part of the generally excellent downtown walking tour. But you really had to search for it, and it basically said, well, you know, Dena'ina hadn't been here very long, and most of them died, and it was kind of a way to basically dismiss their relevance in the history and story of Anchorage. And the first statement isn't even true. Dena'ina have been here for at least 1,000 years. And the second statement, although it does link into some tragic facts about the effects of disease and but ignores the resilient nature of the Dena'ina population today. But now if you walk around and visit the bike trails, and you can read about Chanchnu, which is Chester Creek. Or you can read about Kinchalitnu, which is Campbell Creek. Mm-hmm. You can read about Potter Marsh and so forth. What we're lacking right now, among other things, is a central location where you can go and find out where these interpretive opportunities are. Mm-hmm. And in addition, there are a number of really key Dena'ina places in Anchorage that are yet to be acknowledged for their history and the story that they can tell. A really good example is Point Warnsoff, which in Dena'ina is Nuch'ishtunt, which means place protected from wind. And until the 1940s or the 1950s, this was an extremely important Dena'ina fish camp. And there are elders around today who can talk about their fishing activity. There's even photographs of activities there, but we don't yet acknowledge that place name and that story.
So if you go to Port Warren's off, you
cannot
know.
No, you wouldn't know anything.
No.
And yet it was so critical.
It was.
And that's just an oversight, would you say? Or is there any intention? Who knows? But it just seems like if for such a significant site, it's surprising that there isn't anything there.
I think so. I think we are improving the coverage.
Yes. I guess, I mean, that goes to, before we started, I said I wanted to talk about why this is such a mystery to us. You know, how is it that this local history is emerging kind of now? Even Aaron, as you were growing up, you said you couldn't find out details of your heritage. It just wasn't out there. So let's talk about why that is.
Well, I think there's a lot of different reasons for it, but it's been my observation that, you know, Anchorage is such a young city. I mean, we haven't even celebrated our 100th anniversary.
Yeah.
And there's always been such a big push to, it's like the city of the future. It's like, you know, there's all this,
frontier.
You know, the air crossroads of the world. And so I think in general, Anchorage, it's been my observation, this is my opinion, Anchorage has had a hard time with its history in general, saving historic buildings. And there's not, to the best of my knowledge, I know they're working on one, historic codes. And I mean, other communities are further out ahead, I think, than Anchorage. But I do see it changing. But there's just a lot of different reasons. But I think that with such a rapid growth in such a short period of time, the Dena'ina just got overwhelmed. When my grandmother was born, about 1933, you know, Anchorage had a population of about 5,000-6,000 people. And when my mother was born in 1957, Anchorage had a population of about 90,000.
Mm-hmm.
When I was born in 1981, Anchorage had a population of about 180,000. And
wow.
Today we're over 300,000. So in just three generations, you see this massive growth. And I think part of it was Dena'ina people were just so busy trying to adapt to all these changes that perhaps they didn't or didn't have the opportunity to be as vocal as we would like.
Yeah, go ahead, Jim.
And
yeah.
I would add that Anchorage was founded about 1915. Well, in 1918, mm-hmm. there was a devastating
right.
pandemic, an influenza pandemic. And many, many Dena'ina people died, probably half or more of the population.
Wow.
And very large numbers of key tradition bearers. Shem Pete, who was a young man at that time, both his mother and his older brother died in that pandemic. And so the Dena'ina, who were already becoming a minority within their own homeland, their numbers just dropped. To very low amounts. Entire communities were abandoned. Communities were consolidated. And as Aaron mentions, people were basically struggling to survive. On top of that, they were being told that their way of life was irrelevant.
Yeah.
That they should not speak their native language. And so those
schools,
oral traditions were being lost. And I think it really took a tremendous amount of effort on the part of very courageous people, elders of various Dena'ina communities, to start speaking up again,
mm-hmm.
and deciding that we are going to share what we know. We want people to know this. And Shem Pete, like I keep mentioning him because he was my primary teacher.
Yeah.
He would end many of mm-hmm. his stories by saying just that. Who is going to tell this story if I don't? When
mm-hmm.
I'm gone, what is going to happen to these stories? And he would add, I'm telling these stories so people know them, and I'm also telling these stories so people can save their lives with them. And I think he meant that practically, but I think he also meant that this is a source of pride.
Right.
That this is what's going to save
and
our people.
And even life force, actually,
yeah.
even connection. If you've just joined us, we're talking about the Dena'ina Athabascans in this region. There's a wonderful exhibit open at the museum, which will be there through January 12th. And we happen to have two of the curators, there were three, on the show with us today, Aaron Leggett and Jim Fall. And so if you've got questions about places around Anchorage that you're curious, maybe you've heard stories that they might be historical. I have one, actually. But let me throw out the phone number for our listeners. 550-8433 in Anchorage, or 1-888-353-5752 outside Anchorage, or you can send us an email to hometown@alaskapublic.org. I'm curious, I think I heard about a battle in Kincaid Park. Can you set the stage for us and let us know what that was about?
Sure. Shem Pete and other Dena'ina elders talked about the area around Kincaid Park, that whole area, as being the site of the last battle between the Dena'ina of Upper Cook Inlet and the Aleutic of Prince William Sound. And they believed that this occurred before the Russians arrived. So if we were to date it, perhaps sometime in the mid to early 1700s. And so it was a story where, because Cook Inlet is such a dynamic environment, that there were other Alaska Native groups that were constantly trying to make inroads into the area, and the Dena'ina had to defend it vigorously, both from the Aleutic and also later on in the exhibition. We actually did a film talking about the Dena'ina resistance to the Russian incursions into Cook Inlet as well, and how they fought.
Turned them back, right?
Basically, yeah, they changed the whole the history in some ways of Russian America. There were, at that time, two competing companies. There wasn't actually an official Russian America company, and they were competing amongst themselves, and they were causing a lot of grief for the Dena'ina communities. And so the Dena'ina
said, enough of that.
Yeah, and they, through a series of coordinated attacks, basically, and raids at Old Iliamna, at Old Tyonek, and at Kenai, they drove out most of the Russians. So the Dena'ina knew how to fight when they had to, and did defend their homeland pretty vigorously. So
I'm going to take a caller, but then I'm going to come back to that. Hello, Beth. You're on Hometown Alaska. What's your question?
Hi, I'm Beth Nordland, and I'm with the Anchorage Park Foundation. I couldn't help but call in after I heard a caller talk about a need for interpretive materials. I've worked with Aaron and Jim before. Now that the exhibit is open and we have all these photographs and narrative in writing, I would love to see what kind of interpretive material we can get in our 223 parks, including Kincaid.
Great.
Sounds a bit like a partnership is hatching right here. Jim, go ahead.
Yeah, I would mention on that there has been some progress made in Kincaid Park, in fact, and there are a series of interpretive signs around the new soccer fields out there, and two of them have a Dena'ina theme. And one of them is a general theme about the Dena'ina people of Upper Cook Inlet that Aaron and I helped to write and design, and the other one specifically talks about the battle at Ulchina Bada Hutchilyut, which is the name for Point Campbell, where that battle took place in the mid 18th century.
Wow, it's really fun to have you on, being able to use words from the language. That's just, it's just so we don't hear it, you know. So it's really, really special. I'm going to take another caller. Hi, Caroline.
Hi there. I wanted to verify what I told someone, and I don't, you know, because I don't want to be wrong. I heard a discussion on a talk radio show here in town, and someone made a comment about how there were never any indigenous people living in this area. So I called in and suggested that people take a look at the birch trees down in the park down below Simon and Seaforth's, because I had been told that the wide swaths of the ring around the birch trees that's kind of a charcoal gray, that was where many years earlier the ladies had taken a piece of birch, just the very top layer off, in order to make their birch baskets. And I took a course in birch baskets, the only one that's been offered to my knowledge here, and they were taking the birch, the bark from fallen trees. But the thing that I marveled at when I was first told that about the little one-inch piece, for instance, that over time would grow to a much larger part of the tree trunk, was that the people were able to use the resource, use the forest, but not kill it.
What
so
do you guys?
Was that correct in that?
What do you think about that? Yeah.
Yeah, I would say that's correct. They knew when to harvest the birch bark from the trees. As far as that specific tree, I'm not aware of it, but it very well could be.
There are several of them in that park, is what I was looking at. Not just that it happened one time, but there were several trees that had the wide swaths. Maybe the tree trunk was about 6 inches in diameter, and the space of that charcoal part, which it looked like it looked like a part of the bark, of course, but they under layers.
Go ahead, Jim.
And that was about maybe 7 inches high.
Yeah, I think what this topic brings up is that we sometimes really do struggle to find physical evidence of the presence of the Dyneina in Anchorage or really almost anywhere in the prehistoric time frame, which might lead people to conclude that there were no indigenous people in the Anchorage area, which of course is completely false, but the Dyneina takes some pride in keeping clean houses and traditionally and clean camps. And of course, much of their traditional technology was made out of bark and wood and antler, as opposed to stone and furs and things like that. And animals were cleaned and butchered away from the homes. So these things have disappeared over time, and so. We do find signs of their caches and their house pits, but not a whole lot else. So we are much more dependent upon oral traditions to learn about the way of life of the past and the history up till today.
We still have people here, who have families, who have grandparents and uncles and aunties, and that can, so we're lucky that we still have people here. We're going to take a short break here. If you just joined us, we're just talking about the Dyneina Athabascans of the Cook Inlet region, kind of tied to a wonderful exhibit at the museum right now. And Aaron Leggett is here, and Jim Fall is here with me, and we'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and I'm thrilled to have these two guests in the studio today. Aaron Leggett from the museum, a Dyneina Athabascan, grew up here with questions about what it meant to be Dyneina Athabascan, and he grew up to be an anthropologist and work on exactly that question. We also have Jim Fall here, who's with the Subsistence Division of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, who's been in Anchorage for 30 years working on Dyneina history. And actually, before the break, we talked a little bit about Champagne. Pete, and since you worked so much with Champete, I thought maybe you could share a little bit of the oral histories and stories that he left us.
Well, sure. Champete was born at Susitna Station in the late 19th century, and I met him when he was an elder about 80 years old. And Shem grew up when the Dyneina were still, the Susitna Station Dyneina were still traveling by skin boats and canoes up the Yetna River and up the Chilitna River and harvesting caribou and moose and floating back down in skin boats they call Badi. Shempete was blessed with a phenomenal memory and knew hundreds and hundreds of place names in the upper inlet area, many of which only he still remembered. And he very much enjoyed talking about those places, and he would often string them together in a travel narrative. But his repertoire of stories was really wide, and he knew dozens and dozens of what the Dena'ina call tsukdu, which are the traditional tales of times long ago that talk about the origins of traditions. And
are they stories with lessons, or are they stories embedding the history so you won't forget the history? Tell us what you think. What comes to you about it?
Well, tsukdu usually have a lesson in them about how to live in a good and purposeful way, and often they're cautionary tales about something that's gone wrong, such as offending an animal and paying the consequences of that. Shem also really liked telling histories and biographies, which might have been his greatest
strength,
of his skills. And for example, there is a wonderful early story that he told called Dekalash Tukta, which is a person's name. And in English, he was called Alexander. And many listeners will know Alexander Creek. Well, who was Alexander Creek named after? Well, Dekalash Tukta. Alexander Creek flows into the Susitna River, an important village site for the Dena'ina, highly populated. But Shem's story talks about Dekalash Tukta as a trader during the Russian times and how he would cross Rainy Pass to the homeland of the Upper Kuskokwim people with some rifles or other trade goods and obtain beaver pelts from the Upper Kuskokwim people and bring them back to the trading post at Kenai. And that's one of a series of episodes in the life of Dekalash Tukta that Shempete told, which ends with his death at Alexander Creek in 1906 and Shem's observations of the potlatch and other activities that occurred then. So it's a whole variety of things that Shempete talked about.
I wanted to ask you, Aaron, when you grew up, were you hearing any of these stories?
Absolutely not. I mean, I heard one Dena'ina story when I was in the fourth grade, but I was talking to one of my friends who was in the same class as me, and he remembers this event exactly the same way, and he got a chuckle when I talked about it in the book. But our teacher actually stopped halfway through the story because it gets kind of violent and she didn't understand what the violence was about. In other words, but there was no context to, what the lessons of the story were and why the violence was in this particular story. So no, it wasn't until I got into college and I started working at the Alaska Native Heritage Center, and I wanted to know more about the history of my people because I didn't really grow up with any of it. And so when I discovered books like the first edition of Shempete's Alaska. This was even before the reprint of the book. In some ways, I think we're really blessed for this exhibition because there were so many elders and anthropologists that worked with them and linguists to document these histories. And there were people that were very passionate about this material because they knew what they had to offer was very special. And so people like, we've talked about Shempete, but Peter Kalifornsky was another very important Dena'ina elder. He was one of only two Dena'inas who actually learned how to write the Dena'ina language. And he wrote all these stories, and he has a wonderful book called The Collected Writings of Peter Kalifornsky, Ketlagi Sukdua. Andrew Beluda, who was one of our advisors for the exhibition, unfortunately, he passed away before the exhibit went up, but he did a lot working with his elders over in Non-Dalton. Pete, Bobby, Helen Dick. Helen was another one of our advisors for the exhibition, and other people like Ruth Cockdelash or Catherine Nicolai all contributed to this history that they wanted to see, something passed on. And we're very fortunate that we have a wealth of resources that we could call from, because if it wasn't for documenting these things and these people really in the 70s and up through probably the mid 80s, You know, getting the stuff recorded. We couldn't do this exhibit, or we couldn't do an exhibit
it's
at
that,
this
it's
level.
It's that fragile. I mean, it's that, you know, ethereal. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Jim.
I think one important event was the founding of the Alaska Native Language Center
in
the early 1970s, which brought back to people the value in preserving their language and their traditions. And the Dena'ina, through the work of Jim Carey, a linguist at the Alaska Native Language Center, got very much involved in that. And there are numerous published stories now. Aaron mentioned Peter Kalifornsky's work, but there's many others that have preserved the traditional stories and descriptions of ethnographic
sounds
materials.
Sounds like just in time.
in a lot of ways, that's right. This effort occurred over the span of 30 or so years, but that older generation of elders is now gone, and most of the speakers who contributed to this work is gone too. Aaron mentioned Chempeace, Alaska, which was a book that I had the privilege to work on with Jim Carey. With first edition came out in 1987, and the second one early in about 2003 or 2004.
Yeah, 2003.
It was, and that's a it's an annotated ethnogeography of the Upper Cook Inlet area that features Chempeat, but there are dozens of Dena'ina people who contributed to it, and it's organized around hundreds of place names, and we give the name and Dena'ina, the meaning, the English name, and then if there are stories about that place, those are included, and then there's a number of essays by Jim and by me, as well as traditional tales by Shem and others in there too.
I'm going to throw out our phone number again, just because I feel, you know, people really, I think they're coming awake to this whole history that they don't know about. So if you've got questions, give us a call at 550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752 if you're outside of Anchorage. Or we can also take an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. We have two of the curators and really knowledgeable people about the Dena'ina people of our own region. And one of the things I wanted to do quickly is name some of these books, because if we whet people's appetite, they're going to want to know, well, how can I find out more? We mentioned Chempeat, but how about we talk about Maria Williams, that book right there, The Alaska Native Reader.
This is a book that's published by the University of or the Duke University Press, and
I read some of them. I think you had a piece in there, right, Aaron?
Yeah, myself and Steve Langdon with UAA.
Based on that class. And Jim, I think you've got pieces in there.
I do have one essay that's called Dena'ina Atlana, Dena'ina Country, and it's basically based upon a lecture that I gave at a Cook Inlet Historical Brown Bag Luncheon in 2004, which in some ways was one of the catalysts towards the exhibition, actually, because the theme there was basically the lack of recognition of the Dena'ina presence in Anchorage, and the essay covers that.
Yeah. We're going to go to some calls. We've got some callers online. Hi, Juliana. You're talking with Hometown Alaska.
How wonderful. First of all, hi, Jim. We met at the museum on Saturday.
Yes, I remember.
Okay. He told me to ask him a question and not you. So I do have a question.
Well, great.
On several occasions, I accompanied the man who crafted your grandmother's spirit house.
Oh.
Question for Aaron. Uh-huh. Okay.
Aaron, yes. Oh, yes. And attended your grandfather's grave in the Russian Orthodox Church Cemetery in Aklutna. Would you give us some, I saw various stages of spirit houses in the graves, but some had only decaying blankets. Could you give us some history on the tradition of burying?
So the traditional Dena'ina belief, when a person passed away, they would cremate human remains. They believe that this freed the spirit to travel to Uyan, which is sort of translated today as heaven or the high country up in the sky. And when the Dena'ina started to adopt Russian Orthodoxy, the Russian Orthodox Church didn't allow people to be cremated. They believe you have to put the body into the ground. And so what the Dena'ina did as sort of a compromise was they said, well, if we can't cremate human remains, then we're afraid that perhaps the spirits are going to get confused or they're going to need a place to stay until they can make that final journey. In the Orthodox way of thinking, it's 40 days. And at the end of that 40 days, the spirit would travel to Yuyan and be with what's called Nakhaltani, again, today translated as I guess, God. So they constructed the spirit houses, and traditionally a person's prized possessions, which would have been burned with the bodies, were put inside of the graves as a way for them to stay comfortable and also things that they may need in the afterlife. Unfortunately, today we don't put usually a person's prized possession in there just due to, especially in Kluna, due to the high number of visitors and theft over the years. So each family is responsible for constructing the spirit houses and for the upkeep of them. And some families look at it as sort of a source of pride. It's a way for them to show how much they love the person by how beautiful they made it and also how they maintain it. But others subscribe to an older belief that, again, these were temporary portals that were used to it served a purpose, and then after that they return to the earth. So that's why when you go to the Aklutna Cemetery, for example, you'll see spirit houses in various stages. The particular spirit house that you're referring to, my grandmother's, my uncle has actually constructed two. He constructed one for his brother, who passed away about 20 years ago, and he also constructed my grandmother's. And he is a craftsman by trade, and so as a way of him sort of dealing with the loss of them and an expression of love, he constructed them. And my grandmother's is unique among, I guess, all Dena'ina spirit houses in that he actually welded a metal frame to it, and then he attached the outside of the wooden spirit house to it and used a very high-quality material. And it's actually based, most people don't realize this, but it's actually based on the girls' dormitory that used to be at the Aklutna Vocational School that was there from 1925 to about 1945, where my grandmother, she went to school there. She didn't stay in the dormitory, but he wanted to do something really special for it. And then also on her headstone, we used both English and Dena'ina to just let people know what a special lady she was.
What was her name?
Her name was Marie. Her maiden name was Marie Ondola. She was married to my grandfather, Gilbert Rosenberg. My maternal grandfather actually came to Alaska during World War II from New York and fell in love with my grandmother. And he just passed away a little over a year ago, actually. But anyways, yeah. So that's a little bit of the history.
We're going to go to another caller since I want them to have access to you. So, Julia, thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you for your answer.
And Susan, you're speaking with Hometown Alaska. What's your question?
Hi, thank you. I'm just curious about the perhaps different dialect of the pronunciation of Dena'ina and Dena'ina across the inlet. Are those the same people? Just maybe their traditional area where they were.
Sure, yeah. This is a subject that comes up from time to time. Within Dena'ina, there are four regional dialect areas, and the way I've always heard it pronounced was Dena'ina. I've also heard in some of the other communities, I've heard Dena'ina, I've heard Dena'ina, and then somewhere in between all of those. But it's all the same thing. It all means there's not one way is correct. Sometimes people say, well, you're not saying it correctly. It's Dena'ina or it's Dena'ina or Dena'ina. But it's all the same word. It all means the people, and there's no correct way. As long as you're saying Dena'ina or Dena'ina and not Tanaina, then
I was just going to ask you about
happy about, that.
About Tenina, because that was on one of those downtown signs, I think. And I know my daughter went to the Tenina Child Care Center, so I don't. Is there another word Tenina that's, or is it
It's based upon an old Russian spelling of the name that was basically adopted by Cornelius Osgood, who was one of the early ethnographers of the Tenina. And so in the anthropological literature, the name started to be spelled as Tenina and therefore pronounced that way. But I think in Alaska now, that has passed, and you'll rarely hear anyone use Tenina anymore who has any knowledge of the scholarship.
Okay. Yeah, and I think that there was also, it kind of created this false sense of Tenina, Tanana, Upper Tanana, that it created something that actually wasn't there. That's another reason why it's not used.
That's interesting.
All right, well, thanks so much.
Thanks, Susan. Thanks for calling in. I wanted to share a few other titles with people. I know when I want to dive in, there's a gorgeous catalog of the show. I'm looking at it. Can you pronounce the name of that for us, Jim?
It's Tenina Huch Ilyeshi, which means the Tenina way of living.
And it looks like it's about 300 pages. It's beautiful. And I imagine, Aaron and Jim, you probably both worked on this. Can you tell us a little bit about what's in there?
We, with Susie Jones, who's curator of the exhibition, are the editors, and we all have essays in the book, along with other scholars and Tenina scholars as well, and Aaron has an essay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's over 300, I think it's like 350 pages. There's over 600 images in the book. It's published by the University of Alaska Press. And actually, there are more photographs of objects that we were not able to bring for the exhibition. So it really, when we did this book, we knew that we wanted this to be the sort of comprehensive book on history, material culture, that there would be for the people. Because if you were to try to find this information, you'd have to look in probably 25 different books, most of which actually are out of print, and then there's also new essays for it, and also updates and a better understanding of the overall history and culture.
Yeah. I know this book and the exhibit itself were years in the making. I think you said to us, Aaron, that you were 25 when you got that job. Yeah. And I don't know what you are now, but it's several years down.
32.
And the exhibit just opened last September. So both the book and the exhibit itself were large. One other thing I would like, Jim, I know you have something on your mind, I can tell.
No, I was just going to say, I was going to talk a little bit about the catalog, and that we've been talking a lot about the history of the Tenina, and the catalog certainly includes that. But one of the marching orders that we had from our advisory group is, don't just talk about history, talk about the Tenina today. The Tenina have vibrant communities, is a living culture that is adapting but also looking to its past clues for a sustainable way of life. And the catalog also documents contemporary life, hunting and fishing, as does the exhibition itself. In fact, the first thing that one sees when one walks into the exhibition is a fish camp that is used right now in
Non-Dalton. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's the family of the Ivanov family?
Ivanov family, yeah.
Which was inspired literally by there's even a cabin, part of a cabin set up there.
There's a smokehouse. One of our other advisors, Verna Jean Kolia, actually from Pedro Bay. But yeah, all the Tenina communities had these smokehouses. But we went out there several times. We photographed it. We even, when you walk into the exhibition, you'll hear audio, and that's literally recorded at the fish camp. And so we wanted to really convey the idea, again, that, we're still here as a contemporary people. We're not dealing with, people that are no longer here.
Right. It's not just history. It's still alive today.
Yeah. And I think also the it's fitting that we use a fish camp to start the exhibition, because all the Tenina communities, put up fish in some way, shape, or form. It's very different in every one of the communities because of different regulations and things like that. But
I thought
you were
going to talk about recipes.
There's that, too. Mm-hmm. No two families say that. They always say their way is the best way.
Of course.
But also, it is an activity. If you were to point to one activity that really connects us all the way back to our first ancestors that arrived here in Cook Inlet, it would be the fish camp. And so we've had so much change, especially over the last couple centuries. But nevertheless, catching fish with the family, and especially multi-generational, especially women running the fish camps, is something that is
a thread that
runs
all the way through. Yeah, Jim, go ahead.
And I would add another theme that runs through the exhibition that we were basically instructed to develop is the Dena'ina language. The Dena'ina language is featured right from the beginning. When you walk in, you hear a whole series of Dena'ina songs. Most of the objects that are on display, we learn their Dena'ina name. We can hear the Dena'ina language sung and spoken and in invisible form, too. And you can listen to traditional Dena'ina tsuktu or stories and throughout. And there's narration in Dena'ina in some of the videos.
So you're going to hear that rich language all the way through the
that
exhibit.
That was the idea.
I mean, we just maybe have time for a few more calls. So I'll just throw out the number one more time. If people have questions, 550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752. Or an email to hometown@alaskapublic.org. Something we actually didn't talk about yet, and Aaron, this is kind of directed toward you. I know you did a lot of traveling because a lot of the Dena'ina objects aren't in Alaska anymore. So tell us a little bit about where you went and what that was like.
Sure. Let's see. In 2007 and 2008, it was a whirlwind trip around the world. We went to Juneau to look at things that we started in-state, and then, going back 6 years almost exactly, I was in, we went to Helsinki, Finland, and St. Petersburg, Russia. Then we went to London to the British Museum in the fall of 2008, or excuse me, in the spring of 2008, and then we went to Berlin, Germany. We went to Edinburgh, Scotland as well. We went to the American Museum of Natural History in New York, the A.L. Peabody Museum in New Haven, Connecticut, and the Burke Museum in Seattle.
Wow.
We have some objects from a few other places, like the National Museum of Denmark, that we didn't get a chance to actually go see.
Yeah.
But
so some of those things are in this exhibit, right?
Yeah, everything, all those places that we traveled to, we borrowed objects.
We're gonna run out of time right now. You're just gonna hear our music coming on. I'm so sorry because there's so much to talk about, and an hour goes by really, really fast. But the good news is the exhibit is still here through January 12th. At the Anchorage Museum, I want to thank Aaron Leggett, a Dena'ina Athabascan and a co-curator of the exhibit at the museum, Jim Fall, a cultural anthropologist and also a co-curator with Susie Jones, and he's with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Next week on Hometown Alaska, I'll be back as your host. We're taking up a listener suggestion, moose and mice. How do we keep them out of our houses and out of our yards? We'd love to hear your remedies. Hometown Alaska is on the web at alaskapublic.org. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Alaska Public Media. Kristen Platt is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.